With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hope where not much around Old Trafford. Erik ten Hag's United era begins with defeat as transfer issues continue to swirl around the club. A very warm welcome to you wherever you are around the world to Series 8, Episode 4 of the Manchester United Weekly Podcast with me, Harry Robinson and Jack Tate. Alongside me as always, we're reflecting today on a 2-1 defeat to Brighton and Hove Albion. Two links in the transfer market that leave a strange taste in the mouth. The first game for the under-21s this season and what's to come over the next week. Brentford away in a Saturday 5:30pm kickoff. Let's dive in straight away, Jack. It was hardly, it was the opposite of the ideal start to the season. It was a game which exposed our flaws in midfield, in defence, up front, in goal, everywhere. It was a game that exposed our poor performance thus far in the transfer market. There are still 3 weeks to go, but the fact that Anthony Martial missing had quite so much impact on this United team shows how not only have we not progressed in the transfer market, but we have in fact regressed about 3 years as well. And it looked like it on the pitch.
I think the most damning thing I could say about this performance, the way this felt watching it, was that you could have told me, if you'd have shown me this game with no context and told me it was in April of this year, I would have believed you. Mm-hmm. And back then, you know, we thought that we were in kind of the low point. Yeah, this felt eerily similar. I know I'm being a bit hyperbolic there. It definitely wasn't quite as bad as a lot of the stuff that we saw under Ranić, but the way that we played, the manner in which we performed, the style that we played with was eerily similar to a lot of those bad days under Ralph Ranić. And it did feel like you sort of came to Old Trafford, watched this game, and not much had changed. You know, yeah, we had Martinez and Eriksen in the team who obviously weren't there last season, but you know, they aren't exactly transformative signings. I think both did okay. Hopefully will be good players for United, but certainly don't massively change how you feel about this team. And we were making a lot of the same mistakes, a lot of the same issues that have plagued us, not just last year, but for the last 3 or 4 years. And so it felt very much like a bit of Groundhog Day at Old Trafford.
Yeah, there was a nice quote from a random fan I saw on Twitter or somewhere else who just said, at the end of last season, I was incredibly angry. Having taken a couple of months to reflect, I'm still incredibly angry. I think it's worth us dissecting the game before in a bit of detail and working out, because you're right, it feels like it was very similar to April or to any time over the last 11 months or so. Bear in mind that August under Solskjaer was okay last year. Was that actually the case? Because as one of our patrons, Corey Lennox, points out, we came out with some real intent and Bruno Fernandes had a really good chance within the opening stages. And had he scored that, we might be speaking with a different tone entirely, he says. So he says, what can we take from the start of the match to make sure that we're not having this same conversation next week? And it's an interesting point because although we conceded a chance after 17 seconds, which was Just having had all this build up and having been back at Old Trafford for the first time in 90-100 days, however long it was, and the excitement and the great reception the team got coming out, great reception Ten Hag got to have 15 seconds in a pass played in and 17 seconds a shot come away from it was a nervous moment and a slightly unsurprising one. But after that, the next 10 or 15 minutes there were some nice things there and actually also some really interesting things. There was obviously no focal point. Anthony Martial injured. Edinson Cavani has left. Mason Greenwood is obviously unavailable still. Cristiano Ronaldo was chosen not to play, whether because of his disciplinary problems or because he's just not fit enough for 90 minutes, as Ten Hag suggested. We don't know yet, but obviously there was no focal point there. And so instead, Ten Hag tried some interesting things with a combination of Eriksen, Fernandes, McTominay, Sancho and Rashford.
Yeah, he did. It was noticeably different to a lot of what we've seen in pre-season, which was a big shock to me, to be honest. And I think I definitely will come on to that in sort of a more negative sense later. But, you know, it was interesting to start with. It was very noticeable how far forward McTominay was playing, especially when we had the ball. His starting position was still, you know, roughly what you would expect, but he was getting very, very far forward whenever we attacked. Quite often, he was the most advanced player down the right-hand side, more advanced than Sancho, which was, again, a shock considering that down the wings has been really our most fruitful avenue for making good attacks in pre-season. Sancho and Rashford had been two of our best performers, especially Sancho and Darlow had had really good pre-season together, seemed to be building a really good relationship there. So it was a bit shocking to see Sancho coming quite deep. Darlow wasn't really getting forward too much, and McTominay really being the one to stretch the game on that right-hand side. Yeah, Eriksen was dropping very deep, which, you know, kind of makes
just
sense
on
McTominay and Bruno.
Yeah, just on McTominay and Bruno, it was as if the old formation in football before the 30s was a 2-3-5. And you'd have like that outside. So you'd have the two wingers in Sancho and Rashford, and then the two inside forwards, in this case, McTominay and Fernandes were kind of fulfilling that role. And then there wasn't really, it wasn't completely that kind of central figure to this, which was a bit of the problem. But it was interesting that so McTominay would play just inside Sancho on the right wing, Fernandes just inside Rashford on the left wing. And so effectively got those wingers there to stretch Brighton's defence, which makes sense, especially given they were playing with a three-man back line and two quite attacking wing backs. And then McTominay and Fernandes there to make those runs into the box where the space is being created. And in fact, in the same attack, that one that led to the Fernandes mischance that he really should have scored and leant back and hit over the bar. But just before that, the chance comes from McTominay running into the right side of the area and having a shot that's blocked. And then the ball falls to Bruno coming from the left side of the area. So there was clearly potential there for this to work. And it did work on that one occasion. But as I think you were kind of alluding to there, it took away the impact and quality of the two wingers. And Rashford has been not consistent. Sancho wasn't consistent last year, but both had good pre-seasons. And Sancho, especially, we know, is probably the most talented player in this team in terms of creating chances really regularly.
Yeah, I think the idea, which makes some sense, was that Brighton were obviously playing with three centre-backs. And when you play three at the back, often the wide centre-backs aren't really occupied. They can effectively act as a second and sometimes third defender of the main striker, which United obviously didn't have in this case. So I think the idea was that if Eriksen's dropping deeper, you could hope to maybe drag one of those centre-backs into midfield and then have the wing-backs focusing on Sancho and Rashford and then McTominay and Bruno being the ones to be occupied then by the wide centre-back. So then you'd make sure that everyone in the Brighton defence had someone to mark, which then makes it easier with some good movement, some clever passing to get past them because they don't have that spare man all the time, which you normally face when you play against 3/5 at the back.
Yeah.
I think the problem was just that, well, on the left-hand side, we just never really got anything going well enough. You know, the three of Shaw, Fernandes and Rashford, for whatever reason, we just never really managed to get any play effectively moving forward down the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, where we did have a little bit more success, I think it's just that as much as the system was good to get a United player in some good positions, most of the time that United player was McTominay. And really, out of all of our midfielders and forwards, McTominay is probably the last person you would want on paper in those kind of positions. So we did actually manage to get ourselves into some decent openings, but we never really had the right people in the right spaces. And the big problem was that even taking away who it was in that space, if it was McTominay, he'd often pick the ball up and then there'd be no one in the box because Eriksen had dropped deeper. Fernandes and Rashford were too far on the other side of the pitch. Sancho had stayed wide, as I'm sure he'd been instructed to, because this formation, Dalot wasn't getting forward as much. So you'd end up with McTominay on the right edge of the penalty area with basically no one to play it to.
And then you also had, if you take this from the transitions between defence and attack, that also leaves, so Eriksen was dropping deeper, but ultimately Fred was the single midfielder, which obviously I think everyone will understand those immediate issues to that just as a basic concept. But you also, so you had the reason that Dalot and Shaw weren't seen in the wide areas quite so much is they were coming inside to kind of support Fred in that role. Again, this all makes sense, but it feels too much like it's neither what you'd expect United to look like in the long run, nor is it playing to the team's strengths. And this game is not one to criticise Ten Hag, but just in terms of that, it meant you came away frustrated because you could see weaknesses in the team, but you also thought this isn't like a, you couldn't see that identity that we want to see being built immediately, and even if it's going to cause United to lose games to begin with, and that makes it a bit frustrating. But I just thought, especially Sancho, Rashford touched the ball 35 times all game, Sancho 40. That's not even a touch every 2 minutes for two of our most talented players. And especially Sancho, he creates so many chances, even if they're not turned into clear cut chances or goals, which was obviously the problem last season. And he's really good at that. And I also think the problem with both of them is, and this doesn't help, though, especially in the second half, that Brighton sat back quite a lot and didn't play a high line. But so often when Sancho's receiving the ball and Rashford, they're receiving it, say, 4 or 5 yards outside the penalty area, facing up to a man, and having to get past them. And there's another person behind the defender they're trying to take on as well. And that's, it just feels like we need to give them that ball earlier and let them create chances earlier on in the attacking move and see what happens. And then it's so that they have that space to run in behind after, so that they have a bit more room to work with. And it seems to me like our wingers for a couple of years now have only ever had tiny spaces to work some magic in. And that's why they've underperformed for quite a long time.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying there. I think, like, we've said this so many times, United for the last 3 or 4 years have always performed best when we've had space to work in, right? And so that's why we've, especially under Solskjaer, we were at our best when we were playing counter-attacking football, because that was when we did have the most space. We had all that area that we could work in. You know, the problem is that's not going to be the case all the time. Teams aren't just going to give us, you know, half of Old Trafford to run in. We need to figure out how we play when the space is more condensed and when teams aren't giving us, you know, so much space in behind them to work in. And that is something that I think we hoped, and we still hope, that Ten Hag will improve us in. And we were better at it during pre-season as well. We found ways to get Sancho in particular really, really involved in our build-up much earlier. And I mean, a big thing that I noticed pre-season was that Sancho was drifting centrally a lot more as well, and in very deep areas. Maybe that's, that was just sort of one-off occasions rather than any sort of plan, but there are ways that you can obviously get them more involved. I think going back as well, just to what you were saying, Harry, on sort of Dalot and Shaw and why they weren't getting forward as much and leaving Fred in the pivot, you know, worried about what's coming the other way. You know, this kind of brings us nicely onto looking at the defence and how we did defensively and the goals that we conceded, because, you know, that's where the second goal comes from. You have Dalot and Sancho in the corner, putting the pressure on Brighton, trying to keep them in there, which is fine. I have no problem with that at all. But then they both get beaten by a clearance that manages to fall to a Brighton player. You've then got McTominay, who's our furthest forward player at that point. He's in the Brighton's penalty area as that ball gets cleared, marking their centre-back. You've then got Eriksen as the only other midfielder besides Fred. And Eriksen, you know, defensively, that's not his game. So he gets beaten very easily. And then you're left with Fred, Maguire, Martinez and Shaw against, you know, a wave of Brighton players coming forward in the counter-attack. And that's where that second goal comes from. So that's the trade-off with, you know, this formation that we were trying to play.
It reminded me when you said McTominay was the first one forward, that what's especially strange about that is that seems like there has rarely been the right role for Donny van de Beek in this United team. That seems like the right one. Off the player making those late runs into the box and kind of playing off the striker. Obviously, there wasn't actually a striker there, but that seems like the van de Beek role that he played very successfully as Ajax and that people have spoken about a lot. So because in my head, I was thinking, has he played McTominay there to kind of fill that role until he can get someone to play in that role? And I thought, actually, that is van de Beek's role. Why is he not there? But a lot of this was... This is obviously a work in progress, and what was Maybe it's a good thing, but a lot of the problems here were individual mistakes. So for the second goal, I mean, Fred had a tough task in that single midfield role, but just a lack of concentration and focus. And from the moment that Pascal Gross passes inside on the left wing, Fred runs past him. And then from that moment, he doesn't look over his left shoulder where Pascal Gross is still running behind him for a full 8 seconds. And the 8 second mark is where De Gea pushes Solly March's shot away. And Pascal Gross is there to react quickly. Fred is not. He's looked over his right shoulder, but not his left. And his reaction time is way slower anyway. And he's just kind of, how many times have we seen us concede goals over the last 18 months to 2 years where the ball is played back into the box? So the ball, a loose ball comes in the box, and there's basically a spare United player who is not marking anyone and is just kind of waiting to see how the move progresses. And that was the Fred role. And it was also the Maguire role in the first goal, to be fair. Tongue twister.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are goals that we've seen carbon copies of so many times in the last few years. Cutbacks and then these loose balls in the box have been our kryptonite for so long, because we just seem, basically, it seems like whenever a United player isn't actively near the ball, they suddenly become incapable of tracking players. And it happens so often.
Yeah.
We give players so much time and space in our own penalty area on way too many occasions. There was actually a great rundown of, a great way to sum up the fact that how bad we were at this. I saw people on Twitter blaming De Gea for the save, and I understand he did push it out, but he pushed it to the side. It's not like he pushed it right.
He pushed it to the place it's meant to go, really.
Yeah, De Gea pushed it to the exact place where he's supposed to push it in that situation. And then pretty much straight away in the second half, we had a great example being shown by Brighton of what to do in that situation, because Eriksen had a shot from a very similar angle. Sanchez made an almost identical save to De Gea. It goes to pretty much the exact same point out to the side. And Ronaldo is trying to follow in there, but I think it was Veltman was right there to clear it. It's not really anything for De Gea to do there. It's for the defenders to be aware that, oh, there's a shot coming in across the goalkeeper. There's a good chance there's going to a rebound coming in here. That's like day one defending. That's like under 12s know that.
Yeah, the slight difference is that Eriksen chance was after there'd just been a cross before that, and it had come out to Eriksen as far as I remember, whereas Brighton's was on the counter attack. So there is a slight difference in the numbers back for Brighton. And that was kind of the point in the second half, wasn't it? That Brighton, because Brighton were 2-0 up and yeah, deservedly so, just about. They deserve to be ahead. I don't know if they deserve to be two goals up by half time, but Brighton were deservedly leading and could forego attacking in the second half and have a well-drilled defence with numbers and little attention to attack and be compact and everything. And they did deal with everything except an average set piece. So I guess there's a slight difference in the chances, but I guess the point in isolation is, forget how many numbers were there. Veltman reacted quickly, whereas Fred didn't know Pascal Gross was there, didn't react quickly, just wasn't on his toes and was kind of just a futile floating midfielder. And yeah, these are the basics. And I wonder how long it'll take Ten Hag to change things or to replace those who he can't change. The second half was
the title of this episode, by the way, Harry. Floating Futile Fred. I like that.
Yeah, I don't want to pin it all on Fred because he had a he had a difficult task. But this game did just show so many weaknesses. The second half was interesting. Obviously, United scored, but it was a fortunate set piece error from Brighton. There were I can't think of any clear cut chances. There was a Rashford one on the volley after an Eriksen cross, but that's a really difficult one to finish.
And there was the one on one where it was given as offside, but and it was very very tight.
Yeah.
Like whether it would have been given on VAR,
right?
But
so
he got saved anyway.
Okay, so I didn't see the replay. In the ground, it looked offside immediately as it happened.
It was very, very close. I'm not sure if it would have been overturned, but
that's
it was very, very close.
I had no idea that was even debatable. But yeah, he really should have finished that. But I remember at the time not being so annoyed because I was so certain it was offside. So I'll maintain that opinion just for the calmness of my well-being. In terms of second half, Eriksen better from deep. Martinez won Rashford. penalty area challenge, but there were some, he showed a bit of quality on the ball, as did Maguire, who I thought was excellent, actually. Yes, definitely some blame for the first goal that can be shared around. But yeah, I thought basically the blame of the first goal is the reason that Pascal Gross is free is because Shaw's gone to cover Lallana, who Maguire's failed to be with, and Martinez has also gone to cover Welbeck, who's got past Maguire. So there's definitely some blame there, but especially on the ball, Maguire was pinging outside of the boot passes and clipping balls over the top to Rashford. I thought he looked properly confident and really good. And there were, apart from the goal, there were some good defensive moments as well.
Yeah, I thought him and Martinez did okay for the most part. I mean, like you said, the first goal was a bit of everything, really. Most of which does come back to Maguire eventually. I think I don't blame him for not tracking Welbeck's initial run, because if you watch it, Solly March makes a good run off the back of Fred in front of Maguire. So Maguire steps out to try and cut off that pass. And then that's the exact moment when Trossard plays the pass in behind him to Welbeck. So I don't have a huge problem with him not tracking Welbeck's run. The bigger thing for me is just how slowly he reacted. He turned and then sort of ambled back towards the box, when really, like you said, that sort of set off a chain of events then. Because if Maguire is in position to cut off the pass to Lallana, then Shaw can stay at the back post with Gross. But actually what he ends up having to do is he has to go and mark the more immediate danger with Lallana, which is the right thing to do. But then that obviously leaves Gross at the back post completely unmarked. So
it's just,
Maguire takes some blame on that.
Yeah, it's just the signs of a defence that isn't well drilled yet. And have not had enough, don't know what the word is. Well, I mean, it's training and practice, but just are relying on instincts which are, can often be good, but I haven't got that training into where to go in those scenarios.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I also think De Gea could probably have done a little bit better with that. He was very on his heels. I think he probably could have smothered that cross. But, you know, there's a lot of things going to every goal.
I thought what was bad for De Gea was it looked like he could have been beaten at his near post and could be beaten with the cross.
You got to choose one or the other,
I get protecting the near post 100%, but there was actually a massive gap there, had Welbeck chosen to shoot. So it looks bad for him.
Yeah, and then, you know, outside the goal, I thought they did okay. There were, you know, some clear moments where, like you said, they just need to grow as a pairing, basically. But on the ball, I think they were very good for the most part. There was times where I thought they set us up really well into attacks. But there weren't quite as many of the really good line-breaking passes that we saw a lot of in pre-season, especially from Maguire and Lindelof. You know, that was a real standout from all those games on tour that we didn't see quite as much of. But in general, I thought they were good. There was a lot of switches to the, especially from Maguire out to Rashford. Again, they just didn't really lead to much, but in itself, they were pretty good on the ball. Martinez, like you said, I think he was about what I expected. Good on the ball, very comfortable. You know, I think at times the size definitely will be a factor, and you can see that he's built his career learning to be more physical to sort of compensate for the fact that he is on the smaller side as a defender. And I think he probably will, as a result of that, give away a few more fouls than most, get a few more yellow cards than most. And probably lucky not to give away the penalty in the end. That was a very nice challenge.
Outside of the box, I mean, he didn't really have many, I don't remember any chances for him to show his aerial quality inside the box. But actually, I remember the second half in Brighton's half, there was a couple of times when he beat much taller players to the ball.
Yeah, I'm not actually that worried about his aerial ability. I think
it's probably more on the ground, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's more just ground jewels. Like if a player's
having to resort to shoves instead of strength.
Exactly. That's what I mean. I don't actually think he gets bullied very often at all. I think it's just that he has to do more extreme things to be at the same physical level as his opponent sometimes. And that means he's probably going to give away a few more fouls and get a few more yellow cards than most. But, you know, it feels weird considering we gave away two sloppy goals, but I don't think the centre-backs were that bad. It's just going to be a case of trying to nail down a partnership. And if that is Maguire and Martinez, then that's absolutely fine. I think they can be a good, solid pairing. It's just about giving them time to figure out, you know, how to play together, basically.
Yeah, right. Let's move on to talking a bit about, we've dissected the game in terms of the tactics and mistakes and stuff, but really we know what the cause of this defeat is, and it's the failure over many years to sign the right players, but also this summer. with a new structure in place and still United go into a season without having signed a midfielder, let alone a defensive midfielder, who we've needed for many years. We've gone in without signing a striker, despite having several leave over the last 6 to 12 months. There are other positions we could talk about, but I think those are the two, certainly the most notable. I found the atmosphere at Old Trafford really interesting yesterday. And having grown up around Arsenal as their kind of poor late 2000s seasons became barren years before that little run of FA Cups, it felt so similar to that. And the lack of hope going into a new season was one of the reasons, the kind of familiarity of bad performances on the pitch. But you can really tell it by the atmosphere. And particularly at the start of the new season, I found it, I don't know, not surprising, but kind of saddening that Old Trafford was a place almost from the off of groans and boos. And it's to be fair, it's the same as Arsenal. It's a fundamental sadness and anger from supporters of how the club is run and a knowledge that however hard people try, it's not changing. And that this has been the case for upwards of 15 years now, but more notably the last 9 or 10. But I do also think there's just a rise of incredibly hypercritical football fans. And we've spoken about this before and tried to work out why. And there's social media is obviously a possibility. And tied to that is the fact that every mistake is clipped out and into highlight reels, whatever. There is this sense that every moment on a football pitch has to be perfect now. And that just transmits itself, and the groans and the abuse from around me and in the rest of the stadium when a player tries something now and it goes wrong is mind blowing. And the reason I thought of this just then is because even with Martinez, a new signing, or Eriksen, it was just this instant kind of groans and people kind of holding back abuse that they don't hold back when it's a player like Fred or Rashford or Shaw who's been here for, or Maguire who's been here for longer. And I just find it exhausting to be around, and I can't imagine how exhausting it is to be the person doing that for 90 minutes instead of making some attempt to enjoy the game. But I found it interesting. But I think the comparison to Arsenal is closer than ever before on the subject of that, on transfers. As one Arsenal fan I follow on Twitter said, Tim Stillman, United are entering the what about Andre Santos and part two young phase of the transfer window. Two parody-like links, Marco Arnautovic and Adrian Rabiot.
Yeah, it feels very much like Arsenal from sort of, 2008 or 9 until maybe now. And it also feels quite similar to Liverpool in the 90s as well. Obviously, we have a bit less insight into exactly what that was like, but at least from what I know of it, in a very different era, it feels very similar to what United are going through at the moment. I remember back when Ferguson retired, thinking about, how long it had been since Liverpool had won the league, and thinking it was completely impossible that United would ever go that long without winning the league again. And now here we are, and you're thinking, oh God, are we actually, we could be entering into that sort of
we're about to hit. The 10-year mark is a very notable one.
Yeah.
And we are about to hit it, given that we are so far off.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what's frustrating is that, well, obviously, which is where we are, and where we are on the pitch is one thing, but it just seems to be the same mistakes being repeated over and over again. And I think that is what's so frustrating to me, is that if we were trying something completely new and different, I could take it. I could take it if we fail, because obviously it'd still be upsetting no matter what. But at least you could feel like, we tried something, it didn't work, but we're trying something new. We're trying to go in a different direction, but it just feels like we're...
I also think the point of this is United don't need to be innovative right now. What we need to do is just catch up with other people. So we don't need to come up with a genius way of running a football club. We just need to follow what our rivals, our successful rivals, have done.
Well, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. That's why it's so frustrating, because we're not trying to do anything revolutionary, and we're still failing. Yeah. It's not difficult. I know, obviously, people like you and I and everyone on Twitter and stuff, we all think we can run a football club, and we don't know everything that goes into it, all that kind of stuff, right? But at the same time, I do genuinely believe that you could pick any United fan at random and they could do the same or probably a better job, at least of the on-pitch stuff, than United have done over the last 5 or 6 years. And I genuinely, genuinely believe that. Anyone who is a genuine United fan and follows football to a decent degree, I think could probably do a better job on the pitch than what we've done over the last 5 and 6 years.
My argument against that would be, I think whoever is in that job is hamstrung just so incredibly in anything they can do. I mean, take this summer, for example, where whoever it is, John Murta or say football director, technical director or chief exec, those are three roles where they are still having to wait for sign off from the Glazer family to make signings. And if you have a football director and a manager and a technical director and a chief exec and a head of recruitment and a head of scouting, why, for any other reason than a lack of faith in them or self-importance, do decisions which should come under their remit have to wait until you, the Glazer family, wake up in a different country on a different time zone? United are having to wait to sign things off or to check things or to have some feedback on things to wait until the Glazers wake up. That is just, as my brother pointed out, someone from the US said, imagine if a British NFL team were trying to sign Tom Brady and they said to his agent, oh, you'll have to wait until tomorrow because they've gone to bed. It's just something that you do not get in any other club, in any other sport. And it's incredible that it's still happening.
Yeah, I mean, seeing that, I think it was James Robson that tweeted it today, that time difference was a serious hindrance to United getting transfer business done. I mean, you just can't make that up. Seriously, you cannot make up that is a genuine problem that Man United are having to face.
Yeah,
now.
It's a parody.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I'm not being funny.
As are the two names we're being linked with.
Yeah, but like the Glazer family own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, right, in the NFL. So let's say they're trying to sign a player from the LA Rams. That's a 3-hour time difference. Like, there's only 2 hours more than what we're dealing with from Manchester to the East Coast of America, where the Glazers are based. Like, what's the, there is not much difference here. It's not like these aren't people that are used to dealing with international business deals. You know, like, these are massively successful business people that have global business empires. Like, it boggles my mind that is still something that we're having to deal with now. And that, yeah, at the same time, we have all this sign off, like you're saying, it makes it completely incredulous that why do we have all these football roles, like the chief executive, like the director of football? Why do we even have it if Joel Glazer is still having to sign off on everything? We have one of the most aloof owners in the league, and yet still he's involved to the point where he's signing off on every chat. Like, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. I just think you've either got to be all in or all out, you know? And if you're all in, be fully involved day to day. And you know what? If you want to be like that, fine. Obviously, wouldn't want it to be Joel Glazer, but someone else. If you want to be like that, okay. Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I mean. Be around the club every single day.
No, but also come and live in Manchester. If you want that to be a full, or not even Manchester, United have an office in Mayfair. You could easily, there are plenty of people who work for United who work in London. You could do that if you don't want to live in the rainy north.
Yeah. Or do it kind of like how City do it and defer it to someone else day to day if you don't want to do that. And we've got all the positions on paper set up, and it's just not being used.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too. I do want to rant about them. I don't want to talk too in depth about the two names United linked with: Marko Arnautovic, formerly of West Ham and Stoke, and Adrien Rabiot, formerly of PSG and currently of Juventus. But I do think, and these are coming from reputable sources, that United are interested in both of these. And I do think, even if United don't sign them, it screams of so many problems, because Odion Ighalo was supposed to be a one-off, and it was a one-off we quite enjoyed. Certainly I did, actually, because it had some fun to it. And he was the first Nigerian to play for United, and he was just a boy, a United fan living the dream. But more than 2 years on, and I'm saying, I'm laughing while I'm saying this so that I keep a smile on my face, we're once again signing, or we're not signing, but we are linked with an older forward with an average Premier League pass. This is not Cavani. I mean, there were things wrong with the signings of Cavani and Ibrahimovic and Ronaldo, but they're separate in how old they were. But this is a player with an average Premier League pass, 26 goals in 145 games for Stoke, who has spent the last two of the last 3 years playing in China. And furthermore, the idea that United are now signing people with only the right character, well, this and Rabiot just make that look so blatantly untrue. If we sign a head case of a centre forward, a man who's been accused of racism towards a black player in the Netherlands, to a North Macedonia player at Euro 2020, who was forced to apologise to teammates at West Ham for getting a 33rd minute sending off for an elbow on someone, who disrupted women's training sessions at West Ham, such was his disrespect for them. And he's 2 years older than Danny Welbeck, who we sold many years ago and is doing all right at Brighton now. And then you get onto Rabiot, another average player we can find in the summer bargain bin because his average quality is matched by another disruptive character, not aided by his very mouthy mother who creates problems at every club he goes to and with the French national team. We've had enough of French midfielders with noisy relatives for one lifetime. And I also think it, this matches up with a point I made, I think, in our first episode of this season. Malacia, Eriksen and Martinez are all good signings that I and we should all be very happy with, but they were all obviously Ten Hag signings. So, and Arnautovic and Rabiot seem to be Ten Hag suggestions as well. So where is the input from the recruitment department? And I'm sure it's there, but clearly Ten Hag doesn't trust it at all.
I think what's so confounding to me at the moment is that I think it was in our first episode, I said up to 85 minutes into the game against Villa on United tour, pretty much everything in pre-season and on that tour had gone about as well as you could have hoped up to that point. Everything since then feels like it's gone about as badly as you could have hoped for. And this is just the icing on the cake. Now, what I'm so confused about, right, is that at the start of the summer, we heard a lot about how United have this big focus on signing the right characters. You know, they've recognised that the dressing room was not a harmonious place. That was a big root cause of what's happening. We heard all these stories about Ten Hag, you know, uniting the team, making everyone eat dinner together, no phones during meals, breaking up all these cliques that had formed.
Yeah.
Great. You know, that all sounded like just what we wanted. So even if you think they're the right players on the pitch, which they certainly aren't, how on earth are Arnautovic and Rabiot, two players with some of the clearest histories you could ever find of, you know, character flaws being a big reason, a big red flag on their CV. How on earth are they the people that you turn to? Like, and I know that, especially in the Arnautovic case, Ten Hag has worked with Arnautovic before, which is why some people are saying that that might be who he's going after. But like, he has such a long history of just completely problematic behaviour. Not only problematic in the dressing room, but problematic socially as well. Like you said, with the racist stuff that he's come out with, the really misogynistic, sexist stuff that he's had labelled at him at the past as well. These things don't come out of nowhere. And it is a pattern that has been repeated with Arnautovic over and over again. And the thing is, it's not even like they're great players on the pitch either. You know, like, especially in the case of Rabiot, Arnautovic maybe is slightly different because I know that strikers are harder to find. But I could probably name you 10, 15 midfielders in the Premier League that are miles better than Rabiot and would likely be available. Maybe for a little bit more money.
That's the point though, isn't it?
That's where we are.
That is exactly the point, is that we don't want to spend the money.
But then like, that also doesn't make sense in my head because we've supposedly put up 60, 70 million pounds for De Jong. So the money is there.
Well, yeah, but the problem is that means then if you spend that money, you're sacrificing De Jong, and they don't want to do that yet. But that shows exactly the problem is that United aren't willing to invest enough, because if there is a 100 or 120 or however big the budget the football structure has been given to spend, despite the huge departures in wages that have gone, that means they can't sign someone else until they know for sure about Frankie De Jong, because then they're out of money and then they can't do De Jong. And that's kind of what we saw last season. Suddenly this money came up to sign Cristiano Ronaldo, but that money wasn't there before for a midfielder. And that's the only exception there has been to United's transfer strategy over the last 10 years, where the Glazers have gone, actually, yeah, here you go, have the money. And I think it just tells you everything you need to know. We do need to wrap up.
The only one thing, the only shred of comfort that I've taken from any of these stories that have come out today about Arnautovic and Rabiot is that at the very least, Rabiot is supposedly not seen as an alternative to De Jong, but in addition to.
Yeah, which is something we
at
wanted.
The very least, right. And, you know, if you end up with Rabiot and whether it's De Jong or one of these number of alternatives that United supposedly have agreements with in principle.
Yeah.
You know, I still don't like the Rabiot signing, but at least we get someone else. If it ends up just being Rabiot alone, like if we get to the end of August and we've got Arnautovic and Rabiot on top of what we've already done this window, this summer's been a disaster.
And you would have to hope that this poor performance encourages some better activity in the transfer market. But given the past, that seems painfully unlikely.
Yeah. But I was hoping to wake up this morning to, you know, De Jong is completed. Maybe there's another midfielder on the way. And instead, we've woken up to Arnautovic and Rabiot a day after the game.
I mean, the basic truth is United have lost 8 players and brought in 3 replacements. There is plenty of work to do. Let's go to a very quick youth loan roundup, and then we'll very quickly preview the Brentford game. This was the first weekend back with under-21s football as well, and United headed to Arsenal and to Boreham Wood's Meadow Park Stadium, where Charlie Willens opened the scoring with a free-kick goal. Great free-kick, worth watching. But United went on to lose 3-1 with goals from Kion Edwards, Marquinhos and Miguel Aziz. One before half-time from Edwards and then two immediately afterwards. In terms of the lineup, United, which is of interest at the start of the season, United started with Charlie McNeil at number 9. He was flanked by Matteo Mejia and Damari Forson, with Isaac Hansen behind them and Dan Gore and Charlie Savage in midfield. Savage captain in the team. Also interesting, Mark Girardo played at left back, which he's normally a right back. The Spaniard had a really good time in the under-18s and made between, I can't remember exactly, but between 7 and 10, 23 appearances last season. This is a really interesting one to see how he kicks on. He's a bit of a leader in the 18s dressing room. Very good friends with Alejandro Garnacho and Alvaro Fernandez. And just interesting, he's been tried out in defence midfield before as well. And at centre-back, his normal position is right-back. This time he played at left-back. On the subject of Spanish left-backs, Alvaro Fernandez has now played twice off the bench for Preston North End as they've drawn consecutive games, 0-0 against Wigan Athletic and Hull City. Both appearances off the bench for a total of 46 minutes. He started okay. We'll see how that one develops. And there should be many more loan moves confirmed before the end of the window, you would think. Brentford Saturday, 5:30. We haven't got much time to preview this in detail, but how do you feel going into this one?
I wish Ivan Toney was playing for the other team.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, it becomes an important game, right? I thought this Brighton game was more important than most opening games of the season.
Yeah, because given we're going to lose to Liverpool.
Well, exactly.
We can't lose to Brentford in the middle.
Well, yeah, seriously. I mean, you're going to then end up in real crisis mode already after three games in charge, which, you know, we just can't afford to do it. You know, Brentford they're kind of a strange team. I feel like you never quite know what you're going to get from Brentford. Sometimes they put in these brilliant performances where they're just all over the pitch. They look like they're going to make the game hell for you, basically. But then other games, they don't sort of show up. So a little bit odd, but I mean, their first home game of the season against United, you know, I think they're going to be up for it. The stadium's going to be loud. I think it's going to be probably kind of similar to the game against Leeds away last season, where a big part of this will honestly just be mentally, are the players ready for that fight? Because it's going to be a hostile atmosphere. Yeah. And more than anything, it's probably going to be a relatively fragile bunch of United players who don't have a lot of winning to fall back on. And I think a big part of this is just going to be, are we ready, especially the first 20, 25 minutes, to get into the game, control the game, but also be up for the physical side of it. It's going to be a big challenge.
Last thing, have you got the Fantasy League code to hand? If not, I'll give you a second to find it.
0M4AR5.
But we'll wrap up there and head into a patron Q&A. We're going to talk, what we're going to talk about in the patron Q&A, about whether can United afford to have another building season where we give Ten Hag time, or do we have any choice about which manager could get an instant result out of this, what the transfer activity needs to be, and a couple of other things from Corey, Hovard and Ted in the Patreon Q&A. If you want to be a part of that, have your questions answered and hear a bonus Q&A at the end of every episode, you can go to patreon.com/manutdweeklypod and you can find out how to sign up for as little as £1.50 a week. And if you want to find our thoughts on the Brentford game and whatever, we will be back next Tuesday morning. But in the meantime, you can find Jack on Twitter at UTDTate, that's T-A-I-T. And you can find me at HarryRobinson64 and the podcast itself at UTD Weekly Pod, P-O-D at the end there. Thank you very much for listening on this slightly extended version of the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Have a great week. Try not to let United keep you down. And we'll speak to you next week. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.